Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And Amy,
What?
I don't know how to break this to you.
Should I sit down?
It looks like those crazy kids, Stormy and Glendon, they're not going to go the distance.
You know, I was going to... They had a baby together.
Well, sure.
They're both porn stars.
Norman Rockwell. I mean, this was Americana, this wonderful family.
Why did it end, Dan? Because you're, you know, you hand out relationship advice.
Stormy Daniels and Glendon Crane.
Have you seen Glendon Crane, by the way?
Yeah. All Boy Next Door.
Sure.
Filed Glendon Crane filed the petition for divorce last week in district court in Kaufman County, just southeast of Dallas.
Was he jealous of her rising fame?
He alleges, and
was he beaten?
I can't believe he alleges adultery as grounds for the divorce, seeking sole custody of the couple's 7-year-old daughter, as well as child support from Stormy.
Oh, I see what's going on here.
I'll tell you, if you can't count on a prostitute to be faithful, what is this world coming to?
Well, she's not a she's a porn
star. Does she have sex for money?
Well, she performs and shows her body, often wears G-strings, is topless for money. That's what she's doing right now.
Does she have sex for money?
She had sex and received cash.
What does a prostitute do?
Well, you know, it's the oldest profession. It's when you sell your body for sex.
I'll take that as a stipulation to my characterization of her as a prostitute. Thank you. Witness is excused.
Yeah. So I wonder who her latest fling is.
Well,
I mean, if he accuses her of, you know, cheating on
him. Avenatti, Stormy's attorney.
Oh, God.
Also a prostitute.
Hey-o.
My client, Stormy Daniels, her husband, Glenn, have decided to end their marriage.
Wait, can we get some sappy, cheesy music? Please?
Stormy's daughter remains her number one priority. She kindly asked for privacy for the sake of the family. For goodness sakes.
No, she wants privacy. After she's on stage showing out the...
If there's one thing Stormy Daniels... Stormy Daniels is a private person. She is a private person. And please, let's give the Daniels family some space here.
Apparently
these trying times.
The two met on set when they were making an adult film together and liked what they saw and stuck together and had a baby.
No, I've seen that film. I mean, it's called True Romance, and Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette did it much better. Hey, guys.
Hey, you know why this came to light? Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I mean, I just...
You are getting very sappy over there.
I just wanted to note that, you know, given a reasonable period of grieving,
well,
she will be available.
Reporters found out about this because remember when she was arrested in Ohio? She had marked off that not married on her arrest report. And that's when reporters went, oh, whoa. I thought you were married. And then her attorney denied it, but then now he's coming clean and
saying...
Well,
this was filed 6 days ago.
Oh, right.
So,
okay. But so I'm just saying.
This comes after her arrest.
Right. But on her arrest, she checked off that she was not married. So that's what tipped the media off.
Well, I think what tipped the media off is her husband filing this petition in court. That's what I think tipped the media off. But yeah, I mean, Stormy, Stephanie.
Appeared in several pornographic films together. He went by the name Brendan Miller. If you're a man and you have a porn name, how boring. Hi, starring Brendan Miller. Oh, yeah.
The guys aren't the stars of those shows, from what I understand.
Boy, I tell you, if that doesn't keep you together, I don't. I mean, I just don't know anymore. This mad, mad world. Greg in Schaumburg.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Amy.
Hi. How
are
you, Greg?
I've got an assignment for you.
Uh-oh.
You know, you've always, on your side of the desk over there, wondered why Dan is not married. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine Dan's proposal to a woman in the language that he would use and the contingencies that would be built into it?
How would that go,
so
Greg?
I think,
Give me a
That would go question. Something like this. Dear, I have a value proposition for you that I am sure you're going to find irresistible. It is the product of my dog Hayek and myself putting our brains together, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dear sounds a little informal. I would refer to my betrothed by her Christian name.
Okay, this sounds so fun.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Greg.
Well, I think Amy will clean that up for you, Dan.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Jazz it up a little.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the one profession, though, that would prohibit you from dating someone?
There's not one. But this would be, I think, right near the top of the list.
It had to be at the top of the
list. Yeah. Prostitute.
Well,
no.
Or porn star or stripper at nightclub.
Well, I understand you use euphemisms.
She does all three. Well.
Yeah. Yeah, I.
And this is why.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Right, because he doesn't date prostitutes. How
or
ridiculous
porn stars of me. Or strippers.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
So that, excuse me, that shooting in Toronto yesterday, two women were murdered.
Yeah, a 10-year-old girl and an 18-year-old.
They released the name of the suspect in the case late yesterday. And it was interesting. And my friend up there, Jerry Agar, who's a radio talk guy in Toronto, he was keeping me abreast of this, too. The CBC held back the name of the suspect.
Why?
And then they released the name. When they released the name, they had already coordinated with the family a statement on behalf of the suspect. The family of this Pakistani-Canadian saying, "We're at a terrible loss for words, but we must speak out to express our deepest condolences to the families who are now suffering on account of our son's horrific actions. We are utterly devastated by the incomprehensible news our son was responsible for the senseless violence and the loss of life that took place."
He suffered from depression, lifelong depression, and mental health.
And it had nothing to do with Islam. That was the key.
Right.
Coordinated statement between law enforcement and the family of the shooter.
What were they afraid of?
Well, right.
Because that's what you do when you're fearful.
Also, several police professionals told my friend Jerry Agar that the shooter handled the gun in a way that showed experience, if not training.
Oh, yeah. I saw some of the surveillance video. He clearly knew what he was doing. Everybody described him as he was very calm, and then all of a sudden he'd shoot, 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 reload while he's walking, calm, shoot, shoot, shoot. I mean, it was crazy.
He also was known to police, reportedly. So he's known to police. He had experience, if not training, in guns. The story is coordinated between the family of the shooter and police and the media, by extension, to make sure that they get out that he was depressed and suffering from quote-unquote mental illness, and it had nothing to do with
terrorist
being an Islamist. Mm-hmm. Is that curious at all to you?
He was struggling with psychosis and depression his entire life, they said.
Mm-hmm.
While we did our best to seek help for him throughout his life of struggle and pain, we could never imagine that this would be happening. Hmm.
Yeah, I think I'd like some follow-up questions.
Well, people in Toronto are wondering if their city is unraveling. What's going on? The mayor came out yesterday and said, blame the guns, saying too many young kids have access to handguns and pistols.
Yeah.
Blame the guns instead of the shooter.
Mm-hmm. Who was just suffering from mental illness.
and psychosis.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Psychosis. Throw that one in there.
Oh, related story. We got another shutdown today. I don't know if you saw.
Oh, where?
Lakeshore Drive shut down, march to Wrigley Field.
Oh, excuse me. Now it's getting a little too close.
Right, yeah.
Well, we're going to the beach today.
You can, yeah, NIMBY. You can shut down somebody else's neighborhood, not mine. Yeah, coalition, community groups, concerned citizens shut down Lakeshore Drive and march to Wrigley Field.
When?
That's Thursday, August 2nd. There's a press conference today about it. Thursday, August 2nd. I assume there'll be a Cubs game Thursday, August 2nd. Why would they march to Wrigley Field?
Is it a night game?
Well,
that's even worse.
I think it's a day game, right? Yeah.
No, it's a night game. Seven o'clock.
7 o'clock game, says Mike Scott.
Oh, great. So they're not only inconveniencing Cub fans, but actual, you know, Chicagoans who are driving home from work after a hard day's work.
Oh, yeah.
They want to get home to their families.
Of course. All those city and county workers that live on the north side after a hard day's work, they want to go to their reserved seats at Wrigley
people
Field.
That live downtown or work downtown. A lot of them live in suburban Lakeview.
Oh, no.
So they need to get home. Suburban Lincoln Park.
Yeah, suburban Lakeview. Yeah. No, this is great. I mean, I'll tell you.
Suburb of the city.
This is a bridge too far. I mean, you start interfering with the Cubs. Now you're really. They're in danger of doing something disruptive to some place that people care about. And that's, off.
Is that Father Flager? Because I'll call him right now.
No, it's our friend Greg Livingston from Coalition for New Chicago.
Oh, come on, Greg.
We've had him on the show before.
I know, he's better than that. That's just stupid. It's a parking lot anyway. At that time, anyone ever driven it? It's the worst. It's where you take side streets. But, that'll be interesting. I wonder if they'll give them a lane, or maybe they can give them the flowered median that they can walk in.
Well, just remember, too, if they do go into the stadium, if any of them, any of the individuals, the protesters, are chewing tobacco, they will get fined by Ed Burke, just like Javi Baez.
$250.
So,
first offense. Second time, $500.
You know, sympathy on the chewing tobacco thing. All right.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. I'll feel better if I know Trump is paying attention to Bolton, Pompeo, and Mattis. We'll talk about that when freedom returns at 5.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders suggested yesterday that the White House is considering yanking the security clearances from the Obama six. That would be CIA Director John Brennan, James Comey, DNI James Clapper, clap on, clap off James Clapper, CIA Director Michael Hayden, National Security Advisor Susan Rice, and former Deputy FBI Director Andy McCabe, because they have politicized and or monetized their public service.
They've politicized and in some cases monetized their public service and security clearances.
I mean, Susan Rice was just on with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday. And Brennan, he's touring the country. I mean, they're like on tour and they get paid to speak about matters of security, I think. So why not yank their clearance?
Well, also there's the issue of their actual performance while in these positions, and their performance related to ongoing investigations, Brennan taking credit for essentially launching the Russian collusion investigation. Brennan and Clapper both caught lying, in Brennan's case, repeatedly before Congress. Brennan's time before Congress may not be over. The same goes for some of the others who haven't already appeared, says Bob Goodlatte, House Judiciary Chairman.
We have lots of questions for John Brennan, and he will definitely be sought by the committees for an interview. This is an extremely disturbing thing to see both he and James Comey, supposedly impartial government officials carrying out their jobs in very important areas in intelligence gathering and law enforcement, express the kind of extreme bias that they've shown now, which I think reflects quite accurately on what they were doing back in 2016.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is Trump right to move in the direction of removing the security clearances for these individuals?
Mr. Mean, I call him John Brennan. I mean, all he has been so upset about President Trump's meeting with Putin.
I equate it to the betrayal of one's nation, basically aiding and abetting, giving comfort to an enemy.
And I don't know if he's getting paid for these interviews, but limos pick them up, or nice town cars pick them up at their homes, take them, they do their makeup, they do, you know. So I don't know how they're monetizing on it exactly, but
they're paid. Well, they're hawking books and they're paid contributors to cable news stations. I mean, that's
so
how.
So they're making money.
And speeches and whatnot.
And they said, you know, people keep their clearances so they can talk about information with their successors. But we want to separate ourselves from these people. Don't you? I mean, don't you think it's time?
Yeah, I think their security clearances should absolutely be removed. Not just because they're politicizing and monetizing these issues, which they have some knowledge of from their time in government, but also because of what they did or what they may have done during their time in government, which is still very much under consideration, as Bob Goodlatte sort of intimated.
And they're undermining Trump administration. That's what they're doing.
Well, what do we know about unmasking? Have we ever gotten the definitive word on unmasking? You throw Samantha Power into the mix too, from the Obama administration, the unmasking of American citizens, like Flynn. Remember, that's the one crime we know was committed in this, you know, kind of whole orbit of actual. The Trump-Russian collusion orbit. I mean, yeah, you've got Manafort and you've got some of these others on unrelated crimes to the Trump campaign. But the one crime we know that was committed was the unmasking of Michael Flynn. Have we gotten any reckoning from the Obama administration on that?
No.
Yeah, so Susan Rice.
Was she involved in that?
Maybe. We know she was involved in unmasking. Now she's sort of glossed over that. She's responded to it, talking in vague generalities, as they're wont to do. Why should they have security clearances? They shouldn't have security clearances for this entire time. This is absurd. As you said, they're actively working to undermine the administration. John Brennan is busy putting together a firing squad. Why should he have access to any secret information in the Trump administration?
Well, there's a level of trust, too, that I have zero for all of these people named. I thought that Comey and McCabe, since they were fired, they don't have security clearance anymore.
Well, they obviously have some level of it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be on the list. James Clapper responding to the prospect of his security clearance being removed.
I think it's off the top of my head, it's kind of a sad commentary where, for political reasons, this is a kind of a petty way of retribution, I suppose, for speaking out against the president, which I think are on the part of all of us, are born out of genuine concerns about President Trump.
Yeah, well,
sad.
You can have genuine.
You're done.
You can have genuine concerns, and then there's doing what Brennan in particular, but even to, I mean, I go back again. Michael Hayden tweeting out a picture of the Auschwitz death camp to compare it to Trump's separation of families at the border, which is an extension of the policy that the president he served followed as well. I mean,
I don't want him having security clearance.
I think Trump is absolutely right. I think it's frankly long overdue.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, I'm still working on trying to get through Inagata Davida, and now I've got this song.
Inagata Vida.
Inagata Davida, you never Iron Butterfly? You've never heard that song. Never heard of it.
Iron Butterfly?
Okay. Okay. R. Kelly.
Well, I'm sorry. I don't have time to listen to music.
Right. Okay. For the last 35 years.
Exactly.
Apparently. Yeah.
Well, I'm consistent with myself. Thank you.
Inagata Davida. I think that.
Inagata Davida.
That was about 17 minutes. I think R. Kelly dropped a 19 minute song yesterday. I admit, addressing all of the accusations assembled against him from having sex slaves to being a pedophile.
Oh, sweet.
Here's R. Kelly.
I admit I done made some mistakes, and I have some imperfect ways. I admit I helped so many people, and them same damn people turn fake. I admit it was so hard to focus. I didn't go to classes. I admit that I dropped out of school. I admit that I wasn't that cool. I admit I just feel like retiring. Admit I just don't feel like trying. But all my real niggas around me keep telling me, Kels, that you gotta keep climbing. I admit it, I did. I done fucked with a couple of fans. I admit I'm a gift and a curse. I admit that I don't go to church. I admit it, I admit it. I admit it, I did it. I admit it, I did. I admit it, I did.
Well, worst confessional ever. Not exactly I believe I can fly, you know what I mean?
He didn't get to the good stuff, but what about the sex slaves? And?
He said he's not perfect.
What more do you want him to say? What about the P-tape? Has that already been litigated?
What's the definition of a cult? What's the definition of a sex slave? Go to the dictionary, look it up, let me know. I'll be here waiting.
Oh, so he gave us a homework assignment.
I never said I was perfect. Say I'm abusing these women. What the? That's some absurd blank. They brainwashed, really kidnapped, really can't eat, really real talk. That's sounds silly.
Oh, well, then let them go home.
Sure. He also said he was molested by a family member from the ages of 7 to 14.
Oh, I'm sure that he was. That's because molesters know how to molest. That's why they molest other children.
He did not comment on this song. That's the best line. He, like Steve Harvey, did not comment on Dave Chappelle.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. If the information in the FBI's Carter Page warrant constituted probable cause for wiretapping an American political campaign, then the process and the officials involved in it carried out one of the most significant known violations of American civil liberties in recent history. That's Mark Penn, former Hillary Clinton campaign advisor and pollster, writing in The Hill on the Carter Page FISA warrant after the release of heavily redacted, but nevertheless, some 400 pages of documents related to that FISA application to surveil Carter Page. Penn goes on to say, the evidence here is that there was no real evidence. You had the dossier, the Steele dossier, financed by the Democrats, unverified, so says the likes of Lindsey Graham over the weekend, and a Yahoo story with used as corroborating information, and Penn writes, it's a distortion to suggest, as some Democratic congressmen have maintained, that the Yahoo story was not used in a substantive way. It sure was. Of course, and so was the dossier. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in the application. If they weren't needed, why include them in the application? And Andy McCarthy, our friend over at National Review, has a bit of a mea culpa on the topic. And so we're pleased to be joined by former Chief U.S. Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan and contributing editor of National Review, Andy McCarthy. Andy, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Dan, Amy, how are you?
Good. So you were apparently a bit taken aback by the documents released over the weekend because you've penned this interesting piece at National Review about the confirmation now that the FBI relied on that Steele dossier to obtain the warrant, something you were reticent to conclude up until this weekend.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. What I say is that I, at the very beginning, before we knew anything, told people that it would be silly to think that the FBI, which I worked with for 20 years as a prosecutor and very closely in a number of cases, that they would so radically depart from their procedures that they would take completely unverified hearsay information and just bring it to a court without going out and doing what the Bureau always does to corroborate things. I didn't think that once we learned what was in the application that was made to the FISA court, that you would even have any reference to Christopher Steele or the dossier in it. I figured what would have happened, which is what happens in a normal case, is if the FBI gets a tip, no matter where it's from, they'd take 8 or 9 facts that help them establish probable cause. They'd go out and scrub it, meaning they'd, develop witnesses, they'd, scrutinize documents and the like, and only bring to the court those things that they could corroborate, to the point where at that point the dossier would be irrelevant. It would be the FBI's independent investigation. But I think long, Dan, before we got what we got over the weekend finally, which, I think I've been screaming for as loud as
yes.
anyone from the beginning of Trump's presidency to release this stuff, we've had these congressional hearings that have gone on for over a year, and we already had a very good idea. You mentioned the Grassley-Graham memo. We also had the Nunes memo. We had the House Intelligence Committee release its fuller report. And I think, we've known for a while what we've now finally seen in black and white, mostly black because it's mostly blacked out. But we've known for a while that this is what they did. They brought uncorroborated information to the court.
Well, what does the Carter Page FISA warrant actually mean? What have you learned from reading it? What's the new information, if there's any?
Well, I think – I'm sorry, Amy.
Oh, yeah. No. What have you learned from it, from reading the 400-page-plus warrant?
Well, I was – well, first of all, everybody keeps talking about the 400-page dump on Saturday. I talked about it myself. Mm-hmm. When you really look at it carefully, what you find is it's really not 400 pages of information, and – it's interesting to be reminded of this. I knew about it back when I was a prosecutor, and you had to present these packages for wiretaps to the court. A lot of it is not the actual factual information. A lot of it is blacked out copies of the orders and the certifications. And I'd say that's probably at least as much pagination in terms of numbers as the applications themselves. But the thing I think is striking, I guess, is two things. Number one, I was really taken by Byron York's piece yesterday because he, paragraph by paragraph, went through the Nunes memo, which got so much flack from Democrats and the media at the time that he released it. And as Byron shows line by line, what Nunes said to us about what was in these applications was completely accurate. So I think, the amazing thing, of course, is rather than an acknowledgement that it's accurate, they're it's like they've doubled down on the war path that they're on against Nunes yesterday, which I just think, shows how political this is. And secondly, I'm also struck by the fact that even though the surveillance went on for a year, if you look at all four applications from October 2016 through June of 2017, mm-hmm. they kept recycling the same stuff. I mean, you would think that there would be some dramatic change in at least the portions that we're able to see. But even when they cited to press reports, as we go from October to January to April to June, nothing changes. They just basically copy the last thing they said and they paste it into the next thing they say. And you would think if these media reports were vital to showing probable cause, sometime between, October of 2016 and the midsummer of 2017, somebody would have gone out and done some independent investigation so that they wouldn't have to rely on media reports anymore.
Do you agree with the excerpt from Mark Penn's piece that I read at the outset, that this, based on what we know now, this is one of the most significant known violations of American civil liberties in recent history?
I think he's right about that, but I put this caveat on it. He's right about it, assuming that what we've learned from these investigations is true. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, Dan, is there is, you have to acknowledge, a lot of stuff that's still blacked out that
right.
we haven't seen.
Right.
And if we hadn't had these hearings, I would say, well, who knows what's in those redacted portions. But judging by what we've been told in the hearings, like where McCabe says there's no way we would have been able to get this this warrant unless we had the Steele dossier, or where Comey says we didn't have corroboration, so we relied on the credibility of Steele himself. You know, we do have those bits and pieces. We have the two senators saying there's no information in these affidavits that corroborates the Steele dossier. So they basically just presented the dossier based on what they said was the good reputation of Steele. Since we have that information, I think we can confidently say, yes, we don't know what's in the redactions, but we know what's not in them, and what's not in them is corroboration to this dossier.
And with respect to the argument that was advanced by Jake Tapper when he interviewed Carter Page over the weekend and has been picked up by other Democrats to try and make the case, this isn't political at all, that this warrant was renewed three times, that it was renewed by multiple judges appointed by Republican presidents. So there you go. It's bipartisan. Even Marco Rubio, sitting Republican senator, said that there was enough evidence to substantiate the warrant for Page surveillance. So this is not a partisan issue. This is based on the merits of the application.
Well, you know, number one, it's a kind of a false portrayal of what partisan means anymore. Because the fact that these judges may have been appointed by Republicans doesn't mean that they're not anti-Trump, right? We have a number of people who are Republicans who don't like the president. We've been dealing with that for a couple of years now. But I think, you know, more than that, I must say, I think, number one, the judges did a lousy job from what I can see. That happens from time to time. It doesn't really matter who appoints them. They can do a lousy job. I've never been a fan of the FISA court. I always thought FISA was a bad idea. But let me just say one thing in response to this argument that is, maybe it's a little inside baseball, but I think it's telling. When I was a prosecutor, if you had a wiretap that went on for a length of time, and some of these do go on for many months, one of the things that they always did where I worked in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan was a wiretap case got assigned to a particular judge so that each time you had to get it renewed, when the authorization lapsed, you would go back to the same judge, who would therefore be very familiar with the case and would be able to follow it along more closely. And I think the fact that they went to four different judges for this is an invitation to the kind of sloppiness and inattention to detail that went on here. You want one judge who is familiar with the whole case, and instead they seem to have gone to four different ones, which means you have to recreate the wheel every time and expect that these people are going to, you know, read this closely every single time, even though they're completely unfamiliar, you know, with the underlying facts. I think that's a very inefficient way to go about reauthorizations, and it leads to the kind of sloppiness I think you see here.
Let's go back to your old stomping grounds, the Southern District of New York, in the Cohen case. The release or the wave of privilege over the weekend for a tape that Cohen made involving him and President Trump speaking about the McDougal payment or non-payment. We don't know exactly what was said. We just know Giuliani's characterization and Lanny Davis's characterization and back and forth. And then yesterday, 12 more audio recordings seized during the Cohen raid, privilege wave turned over to the government. These tapes, give me a sense of what's going on with the Cohen case. You've written extensively about this, too, that they're really trying to make out an extortion case here. And that the Trump is in some potential legal jeopardy. How do you read this progression of the case and the waiving of privilege on these tapes?
Well, I think the first thing that screams out at you is, why is a lawyer making tape of people?
That's what I said.
I mean, it's to me, that's really, it's unethical. For a lawyer, if you're going to tape somebody, particularly in connection with legal work, you got to let the person know you're doing it. So I don't get. But I've also maintained from the beginning that I don't think Cohn had what you would call a thriving legal practice.
Right.
I mean, from what we understand, he had a grand total of 3 clients, one being the president, who evidently hasn't really done work for during the time that Trump has been president. And how much work he did before that, we don't know. He said that Sean Hannity was a client. Sean says that that's not true, and there isn't any evidence that it is true. And, you know, there's this one other guy, Broidy, this big Republican contributor who he seems to have engaged to do the same kind of a non-disclosure agreement he did with Trump in connection with an affair that guy is said to have had. And that's it. So I really think that what the government's looking at isn't Cohn's legal work, because it looks to me like there ain't much of it.
Well, do you think that...
But I would...
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, do you think any of the parties would have...
I was just going to say he hasn't been charged yet. You know, I mean, we don't know.
Well, do you think any of the parties would have withdrawn privilege if there was anything incriminating on the tapes?
No, but, you know, I don't know that they're withdrawing privileges. I understand it. What happened is Barbara Jones, who used to be a federal judge and was my first boss, by the way, in the U.S. Attorney's Office, did a review of the evidence that was seized from Cohn to see, was it lawyer-client stuff, which it only is if it's, you know, you're going to a lawyer having a confidential conversation about legal advice. Other than that, you know, they're not attorney-client privileged information. And I don't think, you know, I think what she was trying to analyze was how much of the stuff is actually covered by privilege. The stuff that is covered by privilege, they're not supposed to give to the government. So I think what's happened here is whatever has been turned over to the government, a determination's been made that it's not privileged. And I don't think people are, if you were a client, even if the tapes showed that you didn't do anything incriminating, if they showed things that were embarrassing, you wouldn't want that out there. So you wouldn't waive your privilege on that.
But
I have to think that what we're looking at is stuff that's not privileged.
Well, but Barbara Jones wrote that on July 20, 2018, the parties withdrew their designations of privileged as to 12 audio items that were under consideration by the special master.
Right.
Based upon those designations, the special master released the 12 items to the government that day. And right. Giuliani, clearly the tape that was talked about so much over the weekend regarding the McDougal matter, Giuliani clearly said we waived the privilege, and he called the tape that we haven't heard exculpatory.
Right. Well, what I think they're waiving, I mean, not to get hyper-technical here.
Okay.
But I think what they're waiving is their right to go into court and argue that it's privileged.
I see.
Which is a different thing from it being privileged. But, you know, I just think it's very hard. There's so many of these situations that we're now dealing with, whether it's Trump and Russia or this Cohn situation, where there's a ton of stuff that's important that we don't know, and where we're sort of being led down the rabbit hole to speculate about this or that part of it. And the ball I'm trying to keep my eye on is, has Cohn been charged with anything yet? And does it appear that he has things going on in his life, mainly meaning his business life, that they could be investigating him for that don't have anything to do with Donald Trump? And I think that's what I'm focused on. I do think you're right that they're looking at that, and they're certainly looking at these non-disclosure agreements to see if there was anything extortionate, to see if there was any violation of campaign finance laws. I think that those are both very, very uphill things trying to prove. But I don't know what other businesses Cohn was doing and, you know, why he was a person of interest to them. I would conclude with this, though, by saying, again, that I think that if they thought Cohn was the key to showing collusion by Trump for example, there's no way that Mueller would have let the case go to New York. He'd have held on to it.
Did you see that exchange between Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' attorney, and Dershowitz over the weekend, where Avenatti came? Avenatti came. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, this is where we're at. This is where we're at, Andy. I'm sorry. And he said there are more tapes in response to their discussion about the tape that did come out. There are more tapes, and Dershowitz, well, how do you know that? The only way you could know that is improperly. And so he sort of characterized Michael Cohen and his relationship as evolving. And
well,
so
they ran into each other at a restaurant in New York. I
mean, and so that was he sort of insinuated that was the basis of his knowledge. I mean, does that strike you as strange, does it raise any concerns about Avenatti getting information from the government he shouldn't have?
You know, I just think that I don't know Avenatti. I'm trying to come up with the right analogy for what a debate between Alan Dershowitz and
yes,
you know. It's like, you know, sending Aaron Judge up to hit against Joey Bag of Donuts.
There you go.
I don't know if what Avenatti says is true or not. And I think that, and I, you know, I don't mean to cast any more aspersions at him than what we can say on the basis of how he's performed here. But he just seems to me to be a publicity hog. And, you know, I'm kind of like when I hear him talk, I'm thinking, you know, I want to see it. You know, show me what you got, because I'm not going to the bank on anything this guy says.
Well, now, admittedly, he was crestfallen over the weekend after learning that Stormy Daniels is getting divorced. So he may not have been in his right mind. Andy McCarthy, yeah. Former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District, contributing editor at National Review, nationalreview.com. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Amy, I've identified our next Passport to Paradise trip for 2019.
Please say it's in the wintertime, not the spring.
Well, I hope it's in the spring because it needs to be a little bit warmer than normal. The big trend right now, and I'm nothing if not a trend-sucking dilettante.
Exactly. But you didn't know what glamping was, but all right.
Nacations.
A nacation?
Yeah.
Oh, let me guess. Naked vacations.
Exactly. Yeah. How about hedonism or hedonism 2?
Oh, like
there's also, I've identified more than 30 nudist resorts in Florida.
You know what? I met a couple at our last place in Cancun that this was their first vacation that they've been to where they were.
Where they wore clothes.
Because yeah. He said they always go. He said, don't think any less of us. We normally go
I
to Jamaica.
I see more, I think more.
There's a great nudist all-inclusive colony. But you walk in there in the foyer, then you'd leave your clothes in a bag, and you don't wear clothes the rest of the trip. They don't even pack a suitcase.
This is big business. I know you follow this organization, the American Association for Nude Recreation, the AANR.
Yeah, I follow them on Twitter. Yeah,
the American Association for Nude Travel, Florida region. They did a study together. $4.3 billion spent on nude travel in the state of Florida in 2016.
Because you don't have to pack a bag. You don't have to worry about...
Save on those baggage fees, too, at the,
exactly.
at the airlines.
You don't have to lug your stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
You just bring a purse.
All right.
Some toiletries, and that's it.
That's
awesome.
I'm already envisioning Garrett from Arlington Heights Heating and Cooling naked next year when we vacation.
And what about Rick from Des Plaines? I mean, maybe he can wear his Cubs hat and nothing else. It'd be fantastic.
That's going to be a great trip.
Just don't forget your fanny packs, gentlemen, so we don't have to see those.
That's why I vacation in Alaska.
Yeah,
I have to stay clothed.
Layers.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy and this company, Mowmasters, in Carrollton, Texas. Carrollton's original lawn service, it markets itself. High business standards, follow tax laws, best credentials, ethics, ratings, and reviews.
Employees are crime and drug free. We are insured. Taking back Carrollton one lawn at a time.
Okay.
And here's the rub.
That sounds like a great marketing plan. Taking America back one lawn at a time.
Taking back Carrollton one lawn at a time.
Yeah, because they're regentrification, making people's yards look nice. Property values will go up then.
American owned, your alternative to illegal lawn services. That's the part that's got some people upset.
Could you repeat that, please?
American owned, your alternative to illegal lawn services. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Any controversy? Or do you find this controversial at all? Do you find it inappropriate to market your company as such? Mowmasters.com, American owned, your alternative to illegal lawn services. Would you patronize Mowmasters with that kind of marketing that's on a business card now?
That is hysterical.
Jeff Hinkle, the owner of Mowmasters, said that was a sample card from a few years ago.
Oh no, he's not walking that. You got to own this. He said it. It's out there. Just wrap yourself around it.
He said in a statement, many card samples were made up to determine which wording would be used to let customers know there are legitimate, honest, taxpaying lawn services with excellent credentials and verifiable backgrounds. Well, that's another way of saying we're not illegal. Just said it in more flowery language. Another photo shows the slogan on one of the company's work trucks. The slogan, what was the slogan on one of the
slogan?
Thank you for choosing Mowmasters, a rewarding USA owned legitimate tax paying company. Thank you for doing the right thing.
They had that on the side of their truck.
Mm-hmm. American owned, your alternative to eat lawn services, taking Carrollton back one lawn at a time. You don't have you find this humorous? Well, Fonzie Guzman.
Oh, hey, the Fonz.
Yeah, hey. He said to Jeff Hinkle, up your nose with a rubber hose. No, not exactly.
What?
Here's what Fonzie, is one of his competitors, said.
I don't, wish bad upon him. But at the same time, it's just like, you be careful how you promote your business. Hope his business grows, but doing it the right way.
Unintended.
Not, shaming other people's businesses or their background.
Well, here's the thing.
Shaming. Is that shaming or is that distinguishing?
Here's the deal. It does sound a little racist. A little bit.
Why is it racist?
Well, we're your alternative to illegal lawn service.
Why is it racist?
It just seems a little racist, but it's the truth. It is true.
Why
I've
is
been
it racist?
Calling on lawn care companies for 18 years, and it's hard to find somebody who isn't here illegally. They are all here illegally. And then when the season's over, they go back home to wherever they're from. And then the next year they come back. I know somebody very well. I'm not going to say their name. Close to the family who owned a lawn care service for 20 plus years. And every year they'd wire money to a homeless shelter in L.A. And then they would come over by train or take the Greyhound bus. Very hard workers, very loyal. Never, ever called in sick. They were the most reliable group of guys. And then when the season was over, they'd go back home and take their money. They'd make money for the year for their family and bring that money back
home. So knowing that there are a lot of persons here illegally that are in the landscaping business, what is the problem with distinguishing yourself from that caricature in part, truth in part, of landscaping businesses as primarily employing persons that are here illegally? By the way, in terms of this kind of nebulous charge of racism, three of Hinkle's employees, this is Mowmaster's employees, mm-hmm. three of his employees say they're Mexican, according to the CBS affiliate down there in Carrollton.
All right. Well.
So it's a marketing to distinguish. So we know people are here illegally. We know people come here to work illegally.
Mostly sometimes do jobs that Americans don't want to do.
Well, apparently some Americans do want to do them. They work at Mowmasters. And so why can't he market his company as such without having to endure the charge of racism? 312-642-5600, turkey.pro answer line, 646-360-A, turkey.pro text line. I mean, that Fonzie, hey! Guzman. Yeah, I mean, he was reasonable about it, but it's not shaming other businesses. Well, if you're hiring people who are here illegally, that's what you're doing, and I'm not doing that. That changes the nature of the business. It's sort of like a Buy American campaign. Is Buy American racist? I see the commercials.
Oh, yeah.
By union labor, is that racist? Products produced by union labor. I see you call all kinds of marketing campaigns. Why not this? Tom in Deer Park, you're in Chicago. Want to answer?
Oh, hi, good morning. You know, I'm all for it. Why not build a business slogan based on xenophobia? Give the customer what they want. It certainly worked for the presidential campaign. Guy got himself elected on it, so I see no problem with
it. Why is it xenophobia?
Xenophobia.
Why is it xenophobia?
Because you, I think you just covered it in your discussion. It's basically saying, hey, we're not, wink, wink, we're not hiring any Mexicans. Come and use us. I think it's clever.
Illegal lawn services. Why is it? I mean, it doesn't have to be Mexican. It doesn't say Mexicans. It says people. It's essentially intimating that he's talking about people here illegally, companies that are avoiding the requirements of a legal business that he's not avoiding. So why is that xenophobic?
Well, I don't think he's referring to Bulgarians or Albanians. Do you, Dan?
Well, I don't know who he's referring to. There are people that, other than Mexicans, that come through to this country through the southern border, aren't there?
Yeah, I had a guy that worked on my lawn. He didn't even speak Spanish. It was I forget what it was, but he was like an indigenous. He didn't speak a lick of Spanish. It was like some indigenous language from down in Central America.
Well, okay, thanks for the call, Tom. I don't see why this is necessarily xenophobic. You know, some businesses are operating this way.
Right.
And nobody's disputing it. So I'm saying, here's how I operate my business. It's the same thing as sending out to me. I mean, unless there's some, you know, overt racist nature here, but it doesn't seem to be the case. And the CBS coverage locally down there didn't portray it as such. It's the same thing as saying, hey, look for the union label. I'm a union shop. And so patronize me because I support trade unions. Why is that any different? In fact, this is that's less compelling than this, because the private shop versus the closed shop, neither one of those are illegal or operating illegally. Some of these businesses clearly are, by definition. So why does this have to be racism and xenophobia? Lee on the South Side.
Yeah, you touched on my point is, in defense of what you were saying, it's not racist to mention illegal aliens and that, because if somebody does in fact accuse you of racism, they themselves are racist because they're associating illegal aliens with a specific demographic group. And it can in fact be any demographic group. In fact, my daughter-in-law, who is now an American, is from Russia, and she was here illegally.
Yeah. I mean, thanks for the call, Lee. Look, in the trades, you don't think there's people from Central Europe and Eastern Europe that overstayed their visas or some got here some other way?
40% of people here illegally overstayed their visas.
But I mean, talking about specifically in businesses where Americans do work, which is most of them, it turns out. But okay. So why does it have to be? And why does this have to be so controversial, I suppose, other than on the other side, which is it's so bad and it's so accepted that you actually have marketing campaigns to distinguish yourself as a legitimate business following all of the laws versus businesses that follow some of them. Mike on the North Side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. First off, legal status is not a race, so you can't be racist. Second of all, Mexicans are not a race. They're an ethnic group, and they're multiracial. So this is just wringing their hands and the liberals whining. Right. Now, the only one that complained about overstaying a visa, the Native Americans want the Plymouth colonists and their descendants to leave. They overstayed the visa.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Bob in Waukegan.
Yeah, I would like to never hear from the voice of Amy Jacobson once again that illegals will do the jobs that Americans won't do. Because if every illegal who came across the border was an announcer on a radio station, if they could flood her market and undercut her wage by 40%,
they are. Rojo's killing us.
La Ley, El Terrible is getting, you know, he's on our back door.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, here's the deal, Amy. Yes, I'm American. Sir. I served in the United States Marine Corps.
I appreciate
and I have
service.
Worked and I've worked like a Mexican for the last 45 years. I went to a house in Lake Forest. They had an illegal working there. Yeah. He did all the easy jobs in the house. The lady called me to do three jobs. I talked to the illegal because he was there when I was there. And I said, Martine, how come you didn't do this? And he goes, it was too hard. And I said, how come you didn't do this? He goes, it was too hard. And how come you didn't do this? It was too hard. So a white lady from Lake Forest hired an American to do all the work that an illegal wouldn't do. So I never want to hear that out of you again.
All right, thanks for the call, Bob.
Time out.
Text from 847, maybe he could have just said, we use E-Verified as your lawn service.
Yeah. Oh, that would have been less graphics on the side of the car.
To the extent a small business like that can hook into E-Verify and you know, trust the worthiness of it, accuracy.
And real quick, in reference to what Bob said, it is the people, the company that I know that hired people here illegally, they did work hard. They never missed a day. And I have actually met them. So.
Well, so what?
Well, I mean, every case is different. Bob's situation, what he experienced with people here illegally,
he just said,
different than what I experienced.
He said he's worked like a Mexican for the last 40 years.
He worked like an American because he's a strong American man and he's a Marine. So.
So let me finish now. Oh, boy. He said he worked like.
Yes.
Okay. Can I finish or no?
No, yeah. He said that he worked like a Mexican.
For the last 40 years. And you know what he was saying? I worked hard.
Yeah, he did.
So this is not about people of any particular background not working hard. I mean, that's one of the things, frankly, Mexicans, this hardworking. It's legal status. That's the issue.
Okay.
Lee and Hammond.
You know, as someone that is of Mexican heritage, this is just another bogus argument by the left. It's like the Muslim ban that Trump trying to block people that come from lawless states as a Muslim ban, when it's just the obvious that there's states that are in anarchy. It's the same thing with this. There's nothing stating that they're anti-Hispanic or anything like that. They're just stating the obvious that if you want to support an American company, support us. We are Americans. We do jobs that normally a lot of illegals are doing, and we would like your support. What is wrong with that?
All right, thanks, Lee. John in Palatine.
Hey, Dan. I think I want to make two points. One was that the left picks apart this type because they want it both ways, and they can't make a strong argument, so they have to basically paint everything with the same paintbrush. And secondly, I think the guy is more within his bounds because he's employing people who are here illegally. They are paying taxes like all legal citizens. They are helping support the services that our government provides and not leeching off the government entitlement programs. And so, therefore, he's advertising that he's, that everybody's playing fair. And I think it's a good thing.
Thanks, John.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It seems like just a few years ago, I was leading the charge of Whitey's for Willie. And here we are again, Willie Wilson running for mayor back in 2015, running for mayor in 2019, and caused a bit of a stir over the weekend at a church on the south side of the city when
he decided to help out some of his help out some of the congregants of the New Covenant Church with a little bit of cash for their property tax bill, for their cable bill, for their electricity bill, and the like.
Yeah, and the State Board of Elections said the cash and check giveaway, which was done via his charitable foundation, does not appear to have violated any election laws. Which was strange, though, is the same day that he was at New Covenant Missionary Baptist Church, Governor Rahner just happened to be there on the same day, and he didn't see anyone taking cash.
I did not see anybody hand out any cash yesterday. I think that the idea of handing out cash if you're a candidate for office is outrageous. It should not happen.
So he's come under fire from state politicians, obviously our governor, saying that it seems as if he's trying to buy votes on Sunday.
Rahner's $100,000 donor to the Willie Wilson Foundation, that this was a 501c3, that's where he got the money, he said, that he was distributing to individuals. So there's nothing illegal about that. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Chicago mayoral candidate, Willie Wilson. Willie, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. I say good morning to you and Amy. How are y'all doing as well?
Good. A little short, though, this week. Could use some cash. But here's the thing. So you were at this event with Bruce Rahner on Sunday at the Southside Church. Did you coordinate with Rahner at all for that appearance? Did he know you were going to do what you did?
Well, you know, we do these things every year, and every 6 months. What originally prompted the whole thing was that, you know, my anniversary for my TV show, Sensation, we get out and we celebrated by giving money to people in the community. This time, of course, the taxes went up, you know, and people are going to be short a lot of money, and people are going to be buying their home from there. And so I asked Bruce last year for $100,000, and he gave it to me. And I asked him also this year for $100,000. He gave that to me as well. None of that money of his was used for, giving the cash out. My money, I put $200,000 in there. And a lot of the check that we had written out, some people didn't show up. So we're going to be passing that out maybe, you know, next Sunday, the following month as well. But meanwhile, if we do these things, I'm accustomed to it, that when people hear that I'm in a church donating, giving dollars away to the people that come to pick up with checks, we get 300, 400, 500, or 700 people come through the door. But now these people that come through the door, you know, they don't have, we don't have them on the list. Some is second chances, people, misdemeanor, nonviolent, and same as I bail them out of jail. I turn around and give them cash to have food to eat. Some senior citizen, and some is kids from out the street. When they, you know, come to me like that, unexpected, I always bring extra cash with me to make sure that I give it to them. And so I'm just not going to turn anybody down that is hungry or in need. So I go and I give away what I have. And so I had put into my account, in my pocket, about an extra $40,000, roughly, to give away. So they came in, and I gave it away. Now, Bruce, I believe, had left by then. You know, it was so many people in line and everything. We weren't buying votes.
It was just a coincidence.
I do what I'm accustomed to doing all the time, you know?
Yeah.
I've been doing this for 20, 30 years, you know?
It was just a coincidence that you were there at the same church.
Well, I invited Bruce to that service with me, same as I've done in previous years, you know?
Yeah, Bruce had to go. He had to leave. He had to go give cash to Jim Durkin. So that's why he had to give. Where are you going to go? What church are you going to this weekend, Willie? Amy would like to know. She's church shopping.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, there's a church on Aldama. I'll tell you what, I can take you the address. I don't got the address, but I'll be to church every Sunday. Sunday, 52 weeks out of the year, I'm giving away money in churches. I've been doing that for the last 15, 20 years, and we'll continue to do that.
You are a wonderful man.
it's odd because, you know, first of all, the mayor race haven't even started yet officially, you know. Secondly, when people raise people property taxes out here on people and take their property from them, you know, and shorten it from 12 months to 8 months, those, it means, seem to me, people need to be in trouble, in jail somewhere for taking people's property. I haven't done anything wrong but give away dollars to help the people out there that is in need.
No, so, I believe your heart is in the right place, but do you understand why people see this as you trying to buy votes?
Well, you know what? Not really, because if you check my record for the last 20 or 30 years, I've been doing this all along. You guys know, been on news many times, people we got out of jail and people we give property taxes. This is money that I actually give away. I mean, those people who are doing the complaining, but think about this year. Sunday, if we was in the church, I was the guest speaker, of course, there. I asked people to raise their hand how many people in that audience out there had ever committed or thought about committing suicide. Do you know 75 to 100 people raised their hand and came down for prayer at St. John Church? Now, those people are in desperate need because they got no place to go. So I don't try to stop doing good because of what somebody perceived it to be. I don't need to buy any vote. We have over 2,000 people Sunday or more. Any one of those people would definitely tell you, I did not ask them to vote for me at all. I didn't even bring into my mouth vote for me or anything like that. It wasn't even about political. It was about coming there trying to help others. My record shows this 20, 30 years in a row, all during the week. I carry at least down the street, I give at least $300,000 a year out of my pocket, you know, and just give to people to make sure that they can have food. You know, they hold signs up and everything else like that. I don't know much about the laws of politics. I'm just accustomed to doing what I do.
All right, well, you have to understand, though, Willie, people are not used to candidates for office in this state doing good works. So you have to understand how jarring that is. You're when you're a candidate for like mayor of Chicago, you're not supposed to help people. So this is unusual.
Well, it's unusual, but it's also people accustomed to taking money from the poor. Mm-hmm. I just refuse.
Well, that's what the politicians do. Yeah, that's right.
And I refuse to do that. I never will do that. Why don't those politicians get out and give like me? Why don't they reduce those taxes and things like that, let people keep their home? Why don't they do things like that instead of just taking from the people?
Yeah.
Somebody got to see some light, some good, and then somebody doing good for the community.
I like that.
Help save them.
I like that.
Keep doing those type of things.
Once you issue a challenge to Tiny Dancer to take some of that GTCR money that he made for that year and a half he pretended to be an investment banker and go dollar for dollar with Willie Wilson on the south and west sides of the city. How about that?
Listen, I welcome anybody that want to come and donate to my foundation to give to the people and to the community. I'm not about wrongdoing for anybody. I don't see me turning in for me stop from doing good because of somebody don't claim me trying to steal votes and things like that. Just come in and go in your pocket and give. And otherwise, hey, if you can't give and help people, they just need to shut up, you know?
Well, it's pretty funny, too. Will, you've been around for a while. Do you find the good government types all of the sudden, all of the hand-wringing from politicians and the Chicago press corps that know very well all of the illegal activity that's gone on in Chicago elections since, I don't know, the early 1800s. And they're so concerned about you somehow corrupting this wonderful electoral process and system we have in the city.
Well, I suppose some things make sense, but if you're going to check a personal record, and believe me, you can check my record in and out. My foundation in order, all my taxes up to date. And if you look at all my taxes, you see all the contribution that I give out here. And I suppose that is so corrupt. People have to put in measurement for a different situation and things like that. It doesn't make sense to me, but especially if you look at a person's track record, and I've been brought up to always judge a person for what they do and what you see. you know, and so I'd get this in my mind, you know?
Hey, Willie, I wanted to ask you about the violence, and particularly the south and west sides, but violence throughout the city of Chicago, carjackings and the likes as well. And then the effort by Flager a few weeks ago shut down the Dan Ryan. The effort by your friend Greg Livingston in a couple of weeks to shut down Lakeshore Drive and march to Wrigley Field. You think that these shutdowns and these marches are going to have any effect in terms of reducing violence?
Well, so your first question this year, when I become mayor of the city of Chicago, I'm going to stop violence. I mean, 90% of it. And I tell you this year because 18 to 25 particular African-American males are unemployed, like 49 or 50% unemployed. We have to take the tax dollars and make sure everything is equally shared in all seven communities of the city of Chicago. Because the area do not have economic jobs and contracts and been taken out of there, that's causing them problems to go to drugs and otherwise and things of that nature. Because I've got a lot of people out of jail. A lot of them just ask, say, look, drug doesn't pay. We need to take them and have jobs, and we won't go back in there and do that. On the other question, in terms of Father Flager and going out and doing what he did, I got to tell you, I saw Father Flager the other day. I really didn't see. I couldn't make sense out of that because violence is all over Chicago. It just drew a blank in my mind altogether on that. Not knocking anybody. I'm just talking to me personally. To bring attention to it, we all know violence is high in the crime areas in just certain communities in Chicago. But he did what he did, and I suppose that kind of like threw me for a little gap. And closed down the Dan Ryan Expressway, and I'm not gonna say I'm supportive or against it. Just drew a blank in my mind, and on that piece that, and then for Greg Livingston and I think Teal going out and mm-hmm. everything to do the close down, I believe, of Lakeshore Drive. I believe that they probably may get arrested. I told somebody the other day, and I said, look. You know, Chicago is very segregated. Let's see what happens. It's going to be very interesting here. If they go out and close down the express, I mean, the Lakeshore Drive, will they get arrested or not? Mm-hmm. Now, I was telling somebody the other day, I said, Father Flager happened to be white and they happen to be black. I said, this is going to be a very interesting thing to see.
All right.
So, I'm waiting on that verdict of that because that ain't going to be hard. I'm waiting just to see what happened there.
All right. He is Willie Wilson. He is a mayoral candidate again in 2019 for the city of Chicago. Willie, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, guys.
You have a good day. Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So the Obama six heads of or senior intel and law enforcement officers from the Obama years. That'd be Gus Hall fan, John Brennan, former CIA director. That'd be your Jim Clapper. That'd be your...
Susan Rice.
That'd be your Jim Comey. That'd be your Andy McCabe. That'd be your Michael Hayden. They're on the cusp of having their security clearances revoked because they're, you know, attempting to undermine the presidency and the president administration and making money in the process. James Clapper, clap on, clap off. James Clapper, not happy about it.
I think it's off the top of my head, it's kind of a sad commentary where, for political reasons, this is a kind of a petty way of retribution, I suppose, for speaking out against the president, which I think are on the part of all of us, are born out of genuine concerns about President Trump.
Oh, I do declare politics going on in D.C. Oh, Jimmy.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Juan Williams, our friend from Fox News, Fox News contributor, columnist for The Hill, thehill.com. Juan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good morning. My pleasure to be with you.
So what about the prospect of revoking the security clearance of those individuals? Does Trump have a legitimate basis to do so?
He's the president. He can do what he wants to do. But it reminds me of that body slam of CNN. You remember that video? I think is him coming out and saying, I'm the big guy here, and I don't like you critics. I don't like the idea that people from the, you know, intelligence community, or what he would call deep state, don't like me and are critical of me and publicly critical and use their credibility as former intelligence officials to go after me and call me all kinds of names. So he's getting payback. That's what this is.
Yeah, because they're using their positions, I think, well, for monetary gain, obviously, and to increase their reputations for possible book sales, but also to tear down, I think, the Trump administration. How do you feel?
I think if you have a different point of view, I don't think that's illegitimate in America. You can have, you can say, I don't like Obama. And I don't think anybody says, oh, that means you're not patriotic or not a good citizen, Amy. I think it's like you're right. And then people say, well, why do you say that? And you can explain, this is America. That's the glory of America.
Yeah.
But these guys, by the way, Sarah Sanders said yesterday that they are monetizing and politicizing it. If it was the case that they were going in and getting briefings and then selling that material, well, that would be treasonous. That would be a crime. That's not what's going on here. The reason that they have that kind of continued security clearance after they leave their jobs is so they can be of help to people who are currently in the job, given their experience, their background. They can, you know, offer some guidance as to what's the best way to proceed when the country faces some threat or crisis.
Yeah, John Brennan, James Clapper can advise on how to lie to Congress, for example.
Well, I think that I like the way you put that. It's very, you know, that's a partisan skewer, but I think the reality
is
that they don't sell stuff. They in fact are there to offer counsel, but that doesn't mean they can't have their, you know, opinion about President Trump.
No, but it just doesn't mean they're, you know, entitled in any way to security clearance either. But the good news is John Brennan is going to be able to continue to share his opinions because House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte wants to whistle him before the committee to answer some questions about his involvement in all of this Russian collusion investigation business. So that's good.
Yeah, and I think, again, that to me, that's legitimate. You know, the question is this some kind of star chamber proceeding, or is Goodlatte being serious here and say, hey, I want to know something? What we saw, for instance, over the weekend on the FISA warrant, when that was, you know, was greatly redacted, but when it was released was, oh, gee, now we understand that this was a legitimate process in terms of the FBI beginning to have some surveillance of Carter Page. I think, you know, let's get all the answers. I'm all for sunlight. But I don't like the way that politics gets involved and say that, oh, we're going to punish you, we're going to slap you on the hand because, guess what? You're critical of the president. Well, that's not a crime in America.
Well, on the Carter Page thing, Mark Penn, Hillary Clinton pollster, a fellow columnist with you at The Hill,
yeah,
he wrote yesterday, if the information in the FBI's Carter Page warrant constituted probable cause for wiretapping an American political campaign, then the process and the officials involved in it carried out one of the most significant known violations of American civil liberties in recent history. Is he wrong?
He's totally wrong. I mean, it's not only me saying that, Dan. I think that you hear Marco Rubio, you hear my colleagues here at Fox News, you know, Britt Hume and others say, you know, what we see in the FISA warrant is that people laid out the case. Page was visiting Russia. He had, by his own admission, contact and was acting as an advisor to the Kremlin. He was then in the Trump campaign and was clearly seeking information. And so it's like, well, of course, that's the FBI's job. They're supposed to protect America.
Yeah, except the FISA documents that were released document that they relied on the Steele dossier and were less than completely forthright about it to the judges. And then Yahoo and other news reports that they and now after the fact, after the release, other people are mischaracterizing as sort of corroborating material. It's none of that is true. Carter Page has denied the meetings
that are suggested in the application with particular Russians. He denied that to Jake Tapper. He hasn't been charged with anything. So I'm sorry, where is the there with respect to Carter Page? He's also said he's never met or talked to Trump in his life. So where's the there?
I think the there is that by his own admission, he was acting as an advisor to the Kremlin and that he was in the Trump campaign and seeking information from the Russians that would influence an American election.
Why hasn't he been charged?
That's the there.
Why hasn't he been charged?
I'm sorry?
Why hasn't he been charged with any crime?
I don't think he's been charged, has he?
No, why hasn't he?
But why hasn't he? If he did allegedly do this.
Oh, why hasn't he? I think the reason is that they're still trying to manipulate him and trying to use him in terms of what information he'll provide. And by the way, the fact that he's out there and that there was this FISA warrant, by the way, again, approved multiple times by four judges who were put in place by Republican presidents.
Yeah, that doesn't matter.
I think the reason that he's still out there is that they may agree with you, Dan. He's not a big player.
Right. So the flimsiness of this application to surveil him in the first place is called into question, number one. Number two, Ron, would you at least stipulate that these judges, forget who they're appointed by, they are deferential to FBI and DOJ that come to them for these warrants? I mean, one millionth of a percent of FISA applications have been denied by judges that have been appointed by Republicans and Democrats. So that doesn't kind of suggest that this is so sort of bipartisan support that this was legitimate. It suggests there's bipartisan deference to law enforcement.
Wow. Wait a minute. Is this Dan and Amy? I must have gotten there on the wrong show, because I think conservatives have a great deal of deference for law enforcement and want
corrupted
law enforcement to work in our country. And there's a reason that judges are willing to listen to law enforcement. All this was a presentation of preliminary information. This wasn't intended to convict Mr. Page of anything. It was just simply saying, this is someone we have to keep an eye on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I mean, the probable cost. I mean, am I talking to the Juan Williams? Because the Juan Williams would be concerned about legitimate threshold probable cause being proven.
Correct.
For some sort of surveillance.
You got me on that one. And I'm saying to you, as Juan Williams, what I see in the warrant is they made an extensive case, much of it redacted, so we don't know all the information. But even with what we can see, they made the case. This guy had some contacts with Russians.
Mm-hmm. But they all, but they referenced most of their case on that Steele dossier, which was paid for by the Clinton administration.
And that's
the DNC.
That's there, Amy. It says this was paid, political candidate number one, who turns out to be President Trump. This information was collected by his political opponents. It says that quite explicitly.
Mm-hmm. And how much of it has been verified so far?
I don't think any. I think some of it, obviously, but not the entire document.
Why didn't James Comey tell President Trump, that then candidate Trump, when he visited him at the Trump Tower, and let him know about they might have a tape on him? Why didn't they say, oh, and by the way, this Steele dossier was paid for by the Clinton Foundation or the DNC?
I don't know. I don't know the details of that meeting.
Do you think this Russian collusion investigation is going to bear fruit? Adam Schiff continues to move from one unfounded conspiracy theory to the other. Most recently, after these Page documents were released over the weekend, he's talking about Trump campaign possibly being involved in money laundering with the Russians, but we weren't allowed to investigate that, so I hope that Mueller does. We're just going to keep throwing out different possible criminal conspiracies they could have been involved in when we don't have any evidence of the one that we're focused on.
Well, I disagree with you. I mean, it seems to me that there have been multiple indictments. We just last week, I guess, the news comes so fast these days, it's hard to keep track. But, I mean, even before Helsinki, you had a dozen Russians indicted. We know that the president's national security advisor, former national security advisor Michael Flynn, has pled guilty. We know Paul Manafort is in jail. I don't think this is a flimsy case.
Does that have anything to do with Russian collusion? It doesn't seem to me it does. And Byron York makes the point in the Washington Examiner. It's worth noting how Mueller is farming out all of these cases that are pending because they're outside of his scope of work with respect to investigating Russian collusion. Isn't that Paul Manafort's his business dealings, right? Maria Butina farmed out. Michael Cohen farmed out. Russian indictments in absentia, big deal. Public, that's virtue signaling indictments, at least as it pertains to the Trump campaign or the president himself. So what do we have in terms of evidence of Trump or his inner circle colluding with the Russians at this point?
I don't see that we have any. I mean, I think that this is an ongoing investigation.
All right. Very good. That's okay. I just want to establish some facts here. I want to ask you this other question, too. I got to get your opinion on this. The New York Daily News announced it was laying off roughly half of its editorial staff yesterday. And Andrew Cuomo seemed to...
He wants tax dollars.
Indicate, are we just... he was going to provide some state help to the New York Daily News? I mean, are we just formalizing the relationship between the state-run media here, or what? What is this?
You know, this is an interesting one to me, because I saw that in the stories. Now, half of the staff of the New York Daily News, and I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so I'm a New York kid, and the Daily News was like the Bible around here. I mean, everybody read the Daily News. It was the big paper. People talk about the New York Times. That was the paper of the educated elite. It was the Daily News and, to some extent, the New York Post that was the working man's newspaper and working woman's newspaper. But to see it decimated in this way, to see that they don't have ads, that the ads are all going online, it's just we're in a sea change. And I think a lot of people are particularly worried about local news coverage, that it's just not sexy to go cover the city council or the school board and even the mayor. The mayor's going to get you some headlines, but really, what's the mayor doing behind closed doors? That takes a lot of reporting energy. It's not necessarily, you know, going to generate hot headlines every day, but you know what? There are a lot of important stories about the mayor in Chicago, the mayor in Baltimore, the mayor in New York, and it'd be good if we had reporting. I think that's what Cuomo is speaking to, the loss of coverage of local news. But I agree with you. I get uncomfortable when I think, oh, the state now can call up the editor and say, hey, you know, we gave you several million to bail you out, and we want different kind of coverage, or we want this story covered and this story not covered. To me, that's corruption.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's end on agreement. We'll send on a high note as we try to. Juan Williams, Fox News contributor, columnist for The Hill, thehill.com. You can check out his work in both outlets. Juan, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan and Amy. Have a great day.
You too.
You too. Thanks, Juan. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
There ain't no road just like it, anywhere I found, running south on Lakeshore Drive, getting into town.
Yeah, you're going to have trouble running south or maybe north on Lakeshore Drive on August 2nd because... Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston and his Coalition for New Chicago are planning a Lakeshore Drive shutdown and a march to Wrigley Field to protest the lack of economic vitality on the south and west sides of the city, the violent crime in those neighborhoods as well, sort of a Dan Ryan shutdown redux. This is getting serious now because...
Now, because it is affecting Cub fans?
Yeah, exactly. You're getting to parts of the city now that people in office actually care about. So they actually may have to pay attention to this, other than just scramble some public resources to protect Flager and the gang on the Dan Ryan. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston, Coalition for New Chicago. Greg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. You are the mastermind, man. It's always good to talk to you, Reverend.
Did you plan this?
No. Did I plan him calling me the mastermind?
Yeah.
It's just a fact on the streets.
Oh, okay.
So, Greg.
Greg.
What do you think this is going to accomplish exactly?
Well, you know, it's going to take a lot, you know, and this is just one thing in a series of things that we have to commit ourselves to doing. You know, I've learned from my failures. You know, I've learned more from feeling than I have from not trying. And so, you know, oftentimes in the neglected and challenged neighborhoods, and you made the comment before you brought me on, that the cries of the neglected and the disadvantaged, the complaints are often ignored until there is some kind of lip service given to them during election time. But in better off areas, you know, that the cries and complaints are heard. So We want to bring, you know, the neglected and the disadvantaged to where they can be heard.
So are you going to have the blessing, or not maybe the blessing, but the protection that Father Flager received on the Dan Ryan when they shut that down?
Well, you know, I've been doing this for a minute. We did Black Friday and hashtag Black Christmas 3 years ago.
Oh, I remember.
And so we're calling for some real action against Rahm and Eddie Johnson. I really doubt if Rahm's going to give us his approval on this. That looks – and anyway, we're not asking permission because in the tradition of King and Gandhi, it wouldn't be civil disobedience if we would ask for permission. So, yeah.
What about the Cubs? Are you asking for their permission, or are you planning on stopping the game? Because I could get behind that.
You have to wait and see on that end.
All right,
we'll see what happens with that. Yeah.
Well, what's the game plan? Where are you going to start? Where are you going to stop? Is it the end game, Clark and Addison?
Yeah, we're going to be on northbound Lakeshore Drive at the Belmont exit, and we're going to stop traffic on Lakeshore Drive. Then we're going to march from there to Wrigley Field.
See, now that I've lived there for 22 years in that neighborhood, I understand what you're doing, but I just think that is the wrong way to go about this, because people, they might run you over, and I know that sounds awful, but I'm just telling you the truth.
But Amy, people get run over on the south and west sides all the time. We're used to it. You know, it's not a big deal.
Are you going to wear bike helmets or something? Or
bike helmet?
Yeah, sure.
When the last time you've been in Lawndale, see somebody riding a bike with a bike helmet?
Not since Obama visited.
And my boys don't wear bike helmets either, so it's not just.
We old school, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, so but what is the call? Because I've seen some of your other press releases on topic, and you know, you call for Rahm Emanuel to resign. Well, obviously that's not going to happen. You gotta win elections. You gotta change out the political power structure in the city. And how does this further that real effort?
You know, myself and my co-organizer T.O. Hardiman with Violence Interrupters, you know, we've been neck deep in working with this violence. You know, I'm a pastor of a church. You know, I've done all kind of funerals with short caskets, long caskets, gang funerals with the killer sitting in the congregation. And the sad thing is that way of life becomes normative. And so we have to expose people to something different. Mm-hmm. We want to bring Southsiders and Westsiders, you know, up to the north side, to Wrigleyville, to show them what well-funded communities look like, to show them what public safety looks like when it functions optimally. So when they go back, they can have a different level of dissatisfaction and say, we need this in our communities. And for the Wrigleyvillians, or however you say that, you know, Granddaddy had a dog, Dan and Amy, and the dog was lying on the porch. And the dog was just whining and crying. And his buddy says, why is that dog crying like that? And Granddaddy says, because he's lying on a nail. He says, why doesn't he move? He said, because it doesn't hurt bad enough yet. We believe that many of our fellow brothers and sisters and citizens don't know what some of us are going through. So we have to make them aware, because I believe in the intrinsic goodness of human beings. I look at a human being before I look at their label. And I think that once they know, and then we can show them how, you know, we want some funding for Black-led anti-violence programs. You know, there's so much chicanery and skullduggery out here in the nonprofit world, the political world. You know, I'm tired of political correctness, because our politics is not correct. We've had over 50 people get shot since the weekend. We get this all the time, and Chicago's a laughingstock.
But I mean, trying to shut down a Cubs game, or you know, vaccine motorists who are trying to get to the game or even home from work, do you really think that that's going to work and get your message across?
Yeah, I think so. You know, Amy, the legacy of people like Martin King and Gandhi, even Jesus Christ, is that none of them were palatable during their lifetimes. We praise and worship them now because we tend to sanitize what they did. But it takes getting people uncomfortable to make a difference. It takes your doctor saying, look, if you don't change the way you're eating, you're not going to last very long. And as a collective, as a citizen body, you know, one part of the body cannot suffer and the other part of the body not deal with something at some point in time. We have to get the whole body whole.
Well, okay. When you talk about funding for Black-led anti-violence programs in the neighborhoods, I mean, give me a sense of what that looks like, because this, you know, sort of the never-ending calls for more and more money. Taxpayer money, usually. I'm not saying suggesting you're saying that, but it's usually taxpayer money. That's what the calls are. I mean, the West and South Side neighborhoods,
are wholly owned subsidiaries of the government. Give me what the number is that would reduce the violence. Give me where the money should be directed that would reduce the violence. It seems like nobody can ever answer that question.
You know what, Dan? I know that when Ron closed those 50 schools, at one point it was costing $1 million a day to maintain those closed schools. And so, you know, one of our ideas is this, is that you bring in these huge concerns like Google and you want Amazon here. That's great. That's good. We're all for that. But these companies are coming in with tax incentives and subsidies and abatements and all that kind of stuff. And so they're being subsidized by the taxpayers in order to get them here. Mm-hmm. And so we're saying these cash-rich companies, let's take some of these closed schools and these buildings and these ramshackle places. Let these cash-rich companies invest in these buildings in the community, turn them into digital training centers. And that way you employ the community, the kids of the 21st century already, you know, technology is normative to them. And let's do something creative and let's have vision. And when I talk about black-led, you know, there's a game in the community, Dan. I just got to be straight up with you, man. There's a game in the community. And I can tell you this for a fact. The fifth floor oftentimes only deals with people that will say yes all the time. Mm-hmm. And many of the folk that are in charge or have been in charge of black organizations that don't have any money are not going to sell their integrity in order to get a buck, right? So we need to move outside of the taxpayer base and go to some of these corporate giants and bring this money in. A number would be to have some money that doesn't have strings attached to the fifth floor that says, I'm going to puppeteer you like I puppeteered the illegitimately hired Eddie Johnson.
What about the schools, since you brought them up? I mean, you have this sex abuse scandal that has been unearthed by the Tribune at CPS. And where is the reaction to that? I mean, the CPS is 90% minority. It's overwhelmingly right. African-American. Most of the schools do not educate children, do not put them on a path to success, and they haven't for generations. Where is the outrage over that? I mean, have, you know, Google and Amazon and LinkedIn and whatever, have them take over the schools. Don't just fund digital centers. Start from pre-K. In the city of Chicago, because CPS isn't getting it done. And now we find out CPS was aiding and abetting predators, and there's nary a march or a vigil or a shutdown orchestrated to protest that.
You know, it's hard a lot of times, Dan, to get people together to come up against something when they feel they're already have lost, right? They don't even want to play the game. How can we beat this team? We might as well not play.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of work to inspire them, to inspire the uninspired. I mean, it takes a lot of work. And it's difficult and it's hard. And then we come up against formidable forces. You know, I mean, the Emmanuel brothers have put together this incredible Machiavellian empire, man. I mean, it's off the chain, you know. But, you know, it's hard. And so all I can say is that we just keep trying and keep fighting. You know, black women have experienced, you know, sexual abuse in this country, America, since we've been here, and their coping mechanism, because they didn't have a choice, they couldn't go to a counselor or take a day off, you know, in slavery or something like that. They learned to compartmentalize it, right? I'm not saying that's the healthy thing to do. And so often, though, I believe that legacy is carried over even into this millennia, where many of these young black girls and black boys who have been sexually abused in the CPS system, the parents, you know, are worried about losing what little they have. This is not to make an excuse, but it's just to say this is the reality that exists. I've had parents come to me and say, please don't say anything. Please don't, because of fear.
It's a sad reality.
Yeah, it is. But real quick, you mentioned Eddie Johnson. That superintendent, he walked hand in hand with you guys during the Dan Ryan demonstration.
No, I didn't. I wasn't on the Dan Ryan.
No, he, okay, well, he was. What beef do you have with Eddie Johnson?
Eddie Johnson promised transparency, and he's playing games with the COPA decisions. Eddie Johnson said that in his entire career, he never saw discrimination in the Chicago Police Department, but he still sent officers to racial sensitivity training. Eddie Johnson and I attended the same high school and grammar school. This isn't easy for me, but we both got our big boy pants on. Enough. You know, Rom hired him. You know, he didn't go through the process. Rom suspended the law for a day. Another great example of Chicago corruption. He suspended, you know, the law for a day to bring his guy in. And so now, you know, we get, you know, like the Realmo decision. And the community just says, You need a backbone, Eddie. But if you don't have a backbone, let us do the process over again and bring somebody in here who does.
All right. He is Reverend Gregory Seal Livingston, Coalition for a New Chicago. They're marching on Lakeshore Drive to Wrigley Field Thursday, August 2nd. So mark your calendars. Greg, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mastermind. Bye, Amy.
All right.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy were talking about shutting down Lakeshore Drive and marching on to Wrigley Field August 2nd. That's what Coalition for New Chicago is doing. Suggestion that maybe they take it north to really hit the Champagne Socialists where they live.
You suggested a youth soccer game, which is a great idea. Yeah, I mean, those games are packed.
Interrupt a cricket game at New Truro High School.
Well, lacrosse is big right now.
What else? Croquet. What do they play? Badminton.
Okay.
Lawn bowling. Let's see. We got some other. I did text from 847, March on Ravinia. Oh, yeah. That's it.
Oh,
that would be good.
Steely Dan concert or something.
Oh, my God. Holy cow. They'd be fainting on their, you know, little
picnic
spreads.
Baskets.
Yeah. I like that.
I got a fork in my neck. Oh.
Amy and Huntley, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. I just want to make a comment. My daughter works two jobs. She does cancer testing. And she has a girlfriend coming in from out of town. And all this girl wanted to do was go to a Cubs game. That's all she wanted to do. So my daughter saves her money, buys Cubs tickets.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure about the date that this protest was going to happen, but I'm thinking, you know, that's all she wants to do. She works two jobs. She takes a day off. Her friend wants to go to see the Cubs.
Well,
and then,
well, Amy,
well, if you come in from the Northwest, you can. I mean,
yeah.
There's a safe way to get there where you could avoid the protester, but yeah, no, if you want to go into Clark and Addison where the marquee is, yeah, you might have some problems.
Let me suggest something, Amy, that there's a penalty for bad taste. And and what you want to do is take your daughter, your friend, to Comiskey.
Oh, yeah.
Easy in and out access.
Very easy in and out, trust me.
Good seats still available August 2nd.
Yeah.
You have a little pitch half an inning. Thanks for the call, Amy. Sorry about your inconvenience. Philip on the northwest side.
Who wants to be third base coach?
Good morning, you guys.
Hi.
I would like to see our mayoral candidates and any other politicians and all these people that complain about things while they're marching, you know, all our community organizers and Flager, the scumbag that he is. I'd like to see them talk about heroin and cocaine and crack and meth. I'd like to see that get off the streets of Chicago, because that is the speakeasy of Chicago. We're selling $50 million a day minimum, 365 days a year. And then I'd like to see some real serious vocational schools come back, real serious ones, where they actually make things, create things.
Yeah.
They don't do a service economy. And I'd like to see Common Core get out of our school systems so we get normal, regular people learning things hands-on.
And we got to get rid of the rats, too. We're the rat capital of the country.
Thanks all the rats are incredible.
Thanks for the call, Philip. Joe on the south side.
Yeah, I think that what's needed is real conversion. Conversion of the heart, the soul, and mind of the black people. Now, I live amongst them on the south side. I have some wonderful, wonderful black friends. But they are their own worst enemies.
Oh.
A black man starts to get ahead and his fellow black man, you know, doesn't like it or whatever and robs him blind or whatever.
That's called life.
All right. Thanks for the call, Joe. I don't
doesn't
know.
Doesn't matter your skin color. Sometimes
the white power structure in the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois hasn't done them any favors either, I would suggest.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues now, and make sure to stay tuned to catch me, Mike Gallagher, coming up at 9, only on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, Amy, as a noted theologian, you, of course, know of St. Anselm's ontological proof of the existence of God. You know of St. Thomas Aquinas' cosmological proof of the existence of God. But do you know about 11-year-old William Malice's astrophysical proof of the existence of God?
No, I'm not familiar.
Yeah. William Malice is an 11-year-old who just graduated from St. Petersburg
college with an associate's degree in Florida this past Saturday. He's been called a genius. I know he's an 11-year-old astrophysicist who just got his associate degree, so that's something. And he plans to continue his academic career at the University of South Florida, the Bulls. He one of his goals is as such.
I want to be an astrophysicist.
Okay.
So that I can prove to the scientific world that God does exist.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. He wants to prove that God exists to the scientific world. He's,
and then he'll take that report back to the president of the Philippines.
Yes, exactly. And then, Duterte will resign.
Duterte resigns, right.
Yeah. And
that's part of his thesis, right?
And then Eddie Redmayne will play him in the movie about his life like he did Stephen Hawking after he disproves Hawking's suggestion that there is no God. Here's his proof, by the way. You ready for this? See if you can follow along.
Okay.
This is an 11-year-old. Astrophysical proof of the existence of God.
Let's start with theory of relativity. You know Einstein, right?
Yes, I haven't met him, but I know of him, yes.
Well, in his theory, he said that the displacement of space-time is the cause of gravity. If this is the case, then the absence of gravity, or the absence of space-time, must be pure gravity. Because of the law of flow, things will go to the point of least resistance.
You know the law.
And if there's nothing there to resist, that's the point of least resistance.
Okay.
So, an absence of space-time would be pure gravity. Black holes are an absence of space-time. Nothing, not even light, can escape their pull. Also, if the universe is all of space-time and the entire Higgs field, all of space-time and matter, everything, then whatever's outside of the universe must be an absence of space-time. If that is the case, then the universe is not expanding into the absolute void around it. It's falling. Now, let's think back to the beginning of time. We know the universe has an age, right? 13.8 billion years. So, 13.8 billion years ago, the entire universe was reduced to a singularity, something, a particle smaller than a quark. However, if gravity is always working, i.e. if you jumped off this building, you're not going to fall 15 seconds later, you're going to fall immediately. So, if gravity is always working, then the and if the singularity was always there, like some atheists try to say, then the universe should have no age. It should be infinitely old. But it's not. It has an age. It's 13.8 billion years old. And something can't come from nothing because it would have to exist in order to cause itself to exist, which is illogical. So therefore, something other must have created the singularity. That something other we observe as God.
QED.
That kid's exhausting. You grab a bat and ball and go outside. Well, live a little.
You remember when you had that conversation with your kids when they were 11?
Yeah, right.
About the existence of God and from an astrophysical perspective. Yeah, that's William Mallis. How about that?
Sure he's not your love child?
I should.
All right, surprise.
I should.
We'd have an envelope for you to open up. The DNA test results are in.
I should 23andMe him because, I'd be proud.
Oh, yeah, he could be a distant cousin. Papa. Yeah.
He also could head up the astrophysicist chair, science department at the college that our next guest wants to start. He's Warren Treadgold. He's a professor of Byzantine Studies at St. Louis University, the Billikens, and author of the new book, The University We Need. Professor Treadgold, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
So I read a review of your book by John Leo in the Wall Street Journal, and if it's good enough for John Leo, it's good enough for me. But the case that you make is not dissimilar, reading from the review, that others have made, including Brian Kaplan, about the state of higher education in America. But your remedy is a little bit different than others have suggested who are pushing just walking away from higher ed. You suggest that it's those who have an appreciation for Western civilization and a classical small L liberal education should start building their own castles.
Yes, I don't think it's surprising that I have written a book that says some of the same things that a lot of other people have said, because the situation on campuses of the complete domination of leftist opinion is obvious to lots of people. But the idea of founding a new university, and not just a new college, I would say, and a new elite university, a new research university, is one that I haven't seen put forward as a solution, and I think it's probably the only way out, in unless you wait a very long time for the universities to evolve in a different direction.
Are there any examples that you would point to? I mean, I'm thinking about your prescription. I was thinking about, say, Tom Monahan endowing Ave Maria.
Well, the trouble with the, there have been several universities that have been several, well, Ave Maria is a university. There have been also various small colleges. The trouble is that none of these places can really compete with the big guns of American elite education, like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Berkeley, and so on. They aren't trying to compete, really. They're trying simply to provide a good education to a few students. But I think we need something more high profile than that, some place that really can compete with the biggest universities in the country, the most, well, the most elite universities in the country that have the kind of prestige and visibility that these small places just can't have.
Oh, like such as the Ivy League schools?
Yes.
So how could you do that? What are some ideas?
Well, I mean, you need money, but on the other hand, I find it very surprising that it's been more than 100 years since there's been a major research university, a major private research university founded in America. The University of Chicago and Stanford are really the last ones, and they're from the late 19th century. And during that time, American education has expanded enormously, and there are a lot of very rich people out there who could easily pay for a new university if they pooled their resources, but they choose to give their money to places like Harvard, Princeton, and Yale.
Well, and part of that is because, you know, they're alums of that. You know, they endow departments, buildings, professorships at the universities they attended, right?
Well, that's true, but very often the universities they attended aren't very much like the universities as they are now,
yeah,
and often have very different ideological profiles.
Well, that's, you know, no, there's no question. With respect to the cost, that the prospects of that, is part of it, part of the kind of barrier to entry, just identifying the talent that would provide the instruction and the research at this university, and maybe that's starting to get solved with innovations like Heterodox Academy.
Well, I'll tell you, there are about 1.5 million professors in America, and there are some very good ones still, but they aren't usually to be found in very large clusters at any particular university, and they don't have a very high profile. Heterodox Academy, which you just mentioned, is an encouraging sign, but in fact, the people who are in it who aren't leftists are probably a minority. It's largely an organization of people who are worried, even though they are leftists, that leftist opinion has got such a terrible grip on American universities that they have nobody really to talk to except more extreme leftists, and
right,
that bothers them.
Yeah, right. No, I mean that, right, Jonathan Haidt and Brett Weinstein and the like. What about that then? I mean, if I was a multi-cajillionaire, which I'm not, but if I was and said, you know what, I think Professor Tregel makes a good point. I'd like to put some money in and scrape together, I don't know, the $1 billion I think you put the price tag on that it would take to start something on this order of magnitude. Where do I go to get the people that are going to pass the legitimacy test so that you attract the top students?
Well, you advertise, and you probably begin by advertising in all fields and all ranks for people who are interested in that kind of a university, and I think you'd find a huge number of people would apply. Not all of them, of course, would be the sorts of people that were top-notch and whom you'd want, but I think that you'd find about, I think you wouldn't have much trouble finding several hundred. Remember that this university doesn't have to be enormous. I suggest a faculty of about 1,000 in all fields, and you wouldn't, of course, hire them all at once right away. I think you'd get them. it's a lot of those people now, it's hard to say exactly where they are and who they are in some cases, because they have to keep very low profiles, because it's not a good thing to be identified as a conservative or a moderate in American universities today.
What about looking at examples that run counter to the prevailing trend we're discussing in higher education and trying to scale or replicate those, like, for example, Hillsdale College or the University of Dallas?
Well, these are places that, by and large, do not try to be the best university in the country. And, well, there are two things here. One is that if they're small enough, they really can't be. They can't provide the kind of research, the kind of research facilities that would attract scholars who want to be at a major research university, and those are the people who really have prestige in American academics today. Mm-hmm. And part of the trouble is that a lot of them are more concerned with ideological purity and frankly, athletics than they are with academic excellence.
All right. He is Warren Treadgold, professor of Byzantine Studies at St. Louis University. The book, The University We Need. Professor Treadgold, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
And thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
I love this story because you know how people listen to other people's conversations on a plane sometimes? Well, this girl, Kimberly, she's a teacher at CPS. So roll your eyes. She teaches at Chicago's Carlos Fuentes Elementary School. She has 32 first graders in her class. Can you imagine the chaos? And somebody next to her on a Southwest Airlines flight asked her, hey, you know, what's it like working where you are? What's your greatest challenge as a teacher? And she said, working at a low-income school, that it's heartbreaking because many of the children are from immigrant families and they're living in poverty. So she told this, you know, story. And the guy sitting next to her, you know, who asked her the question, like, you know what, I'm going to see if my work can contact you and donate some items. Then a man sitting behind her tapped her on the shoulder, handed her a wad of cash. He had, maybe he just got back from Vegas or something, but $500 in cash. Then she started crying. Then the person across the aisle who was eavesdropping handed her $20. Then the man sitting in front of her turned around and said, this is all I have, and gave her a measly $10. And then they beat him to a pulp. No. So she got all this money, walked off the plane with $530. She says she's going to use the money to purchase books, some in English and some in Spanish, to help her students.
Right, because CPS can't afford books. Yeah, CPS at $20,000 a kid can't afford books. That's the real deal there.
Pens and paper and crayons. She said she just wanted to give them a big hug. But then since this started, she has a GoFundMe page now. And
great. Good.
Oh, no, all the money is going to go
to her pension.
To supplies. No, to school supplies.
Oh, school supplies. So, of course, yeah, school supplies. No, everybody knows that it's about the kids in CPS.
Well,
there
for
is
this
no
teacher,
question.
It's about the kids.
Yeah, that's nice.
She has 32 kids, so good for her. Name is Kimberly Bermudez.
Mm. All she had to do to get her name on the air was endure her name being assassinated.
How do you, Kimberly Bermudez?
Bermudez, yeah.
Yeah. So she's at Carlos Fuentes Elementary School. Good for her. So sometimes when people eavesdrop on your phone or your conversations on a plane, it could be a good thing. I'm going to complain about my property taxes being too high.
I thought this is where this is going.
Well, that's what I'm going to get it ready.
All right.
The next time.
Just to go to the church Willie Wilson's going to be at this weekend.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.